You can now download a free PDF copy or a beautiful printed copy of issue number 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we are going to have a very unusual interview, and the reason is that 8 years ago I recorded a video with Dr. Vernon Nepi, who is co-author with physicist Ed Close of the book Reality Begins with Consciousness. And in that interview, which was never publicly released 8 years ago, Dr. Nepi went into some detail about what I have called archetypal synchronistic resonance, which is another way of thinking about certain potential reincarnation cases. And we are releasing that interview publicly. It has been released now after 8 years, and I'm going to link to it in the upper right-hand corner of your screen if you haven't seen that video now. And if you have a computer that's capable of reading the link, you can link directly to it. In that interview, Dr. Nepi talked about a potential past life or archetypal synchronistic resonant connection with the great mathematician George Cantor. And he pointed out that his colleague, Ed Close, had a similar connection with the great mathematician Pierre Fermat. Now, today, 8 years later, both Vernon Nepi and Ed Close are ready to go public with these revelations. 8 years ago, that was not the case because both individuals were concerned about how revelations concerning possible past lives might affect their professional standing. But they're both at a point in their careers now where that's less important to them. And they're both with me today to refresh their memories and my memories and the viewers' memories about these potential reincarnation connections. Welcome, Ed and Vernon.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff.
So let me begin by asking you, Vernon, this question. Since it's been 8 years since we made the original video, what has changed in your thinking that has allowed you to feel comfortable revealing this potential past life connection?
Very good question. First of all, professionally, there are certain changes. I still am working in sort of the forensic neuropsychiatry, behavioral neurology, psychopharmacology area, but not very much. But I realized that the knowledge of these connections between Ed Close and myself and Pierre de Fermat and Georges Cantor and the extra connections with Leibniz and with von Kussfeld are so important because I've learned about their uniqueness in terms of possible reincarnation. And there is no memory component. I think Ed has one. He might want to mention that. But there is nothing special there. But what is interesting is that we both continued our learning and our research in this direction. And I think it was so important that we said, let's make this public before we had made it public, private, and just allowed a few people to watch.
Let me ask you, Ed, as a long-term meditator, and I want our viewers to know that we also have done several interviews in the past, and you've talked extensively about your practice of Kriya Yoga. In fact, I'm going to link to some of those earlier interviews now as well in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. You've told me that you actually, unlike Vernon, have had some conscious memories of past lives.
Yes, that's probably one of the main differences, I would say. And that the fact that I've had specific memories of specific past lives, especially after I had the initiation into Kriya practice in 1960, these were brought more clearly into focus. But I also had memories from before, and I have written about these, as you and Vernon both alluded to, in actually my first published book, The Book of Atma, published in 1977 by Libra Publishers in New York. And I also included in, as an appendix in that book, the 1965 proof of Fermat's Last Theorem, which I completed while I was teaching mathematics between 1962 and 1967. So all of these things kind of hold together. My point of view, I try to maintain a point of view as a scientist, but I can't deny what I know is true through direct experience in deep meditation of these connections. So the important thing to me is not necessarily to prove that I was or that I am a reincarnation of any person in the past, because in my opinion, this is an overly simplistic idea about reincarnation that is prevalent in the West and is really due to misinformation or lack of information, when actually there are far more people in the world who believe in, and I don't even like to use the word believe, but who either believe or know through direct experience that they have connections in consciousness with certain people in the past. And this fits into a couple of things that might be worth considering. For instance, Erwin Schrödinger, the physicist who helped get quantum physics started off, actually made the statement in his little book, What is Life?, which is a number of essays by Erwin Schrödinger, that there's no evidence that consciousness has a plural. Now, this is a little hard for linear thinking, which is promoted in the West, to grasp, because we like to connect things A to B to C in a linear fashion. But in fact, if consciousness is only one, then we all have, so to speak, sparks or droplets of that one thing, which we'll call consciousness. I happen to believe that it is also in the Eastern tradition of Tibet and India, where the ancient language was Sanskrit, that the connection there is that we're all part of this one unified thing, and that what in science we are calling, in physics, the physicists are calling the zero-point field, quantum field, is actually what in the Sanskrit writings of Patanjali and before that were called Akasha, or the Akashic record. From my point of view, the Akasha is the substrate or the background of consciousness, which is the logical system, or the system or framework of logic from which all things originate. This is an integrating concept, and I think that it underlies a lot of philosophies around the world, especially, and I make the distinction between religions and spiritual philosophy. And one of my memories, which I shared with my late wife, Jackie, was of a life that we shared in Tibet, in between the Fermat experience and the Johann Leibniz experience in the 17th century. So my proclivity, because I grew up with two grandparents who were of German descent and spoke the German language, to those things made me relate more easily to Leibniz and at Leibniz, the German mathematician and polymath Leibniz, and their relationship in Germany in that period of time. So this kind of explains why memories, and let me kind of tie this up with one final comment, that the memories that I have of past lives do not include many details like exact dates or exact place names or that sort of thing. They're more like the things that you might remember from your childhood that had an emotional impact. And this is why my position is I've tired of trying to convince people of any of the things that I remember, including the proof of Fermat's last theorem in 1965, and just let people believe whatever they want to. At my stage in life, it makes no difference to me what anybody believes, and I'm not trying to convince anybody. I'm just reporting on my own experience. So with that, I'll stop talking.
Well, let me pursue a little further with you, Ed. What I think I hear you saying is that you have a distinct memory of having been in Tibet sometime after Fermat's lifetime. But I gather that you also and correct me if I'm wrong, you don't have any particular memories of ever having been Fermat.
I have some memories that I connect with Fermat when I delve into his proofs using the method of infinite descent. Fermat's greatest contribution, in my opinion, was using infinite descent to prove negative propositions. You'll find people now saying, well, you can't prove a negative. That's not true. To prove a negative is more difficult, but any mathematician who has much knowledge of number theory will tell you that you definitely can, or even someone versed in the methods of symbolic logic will tell you that it is the statement that you can't prove a negative is totally incorrect. Anyone who says that is just repeating a falsehood. But at any rate, to answer your question, when I delved into those methods, which were, by the way, different than the way I think now because of the difference in notation. And people confuse notation with mathematics. Mathematics, pure math, is a reflection of the structure, the logical structure of reality. And there are certain theorems that prove these concepts. And once they're proved, it's like exploring. You explore mathematics the same way you might explore a countryside. And so that's a misunderstanding due to our educational system, I think, in the Western world, of trying to prove things in a linear manner without realizing that's all part of a whole picture. So when I delved into Fermat's method of proving Diophantine equations, for reference, of Diophantine equation as equation for which we're only interested in whole number solutions. Diophantine equations taken as part of the real number system, so-called, can have solutions. But Fermat's Last Theorem was a negative statement that this particular equation had no integer solutions. Why that's important is because in modern science, with the discovery of the quantum, mass and energy are both quantized, then it's important to be able to solve Diophantine equations, and that takes a different calculus than the infinitesimal calculus was developed by Newton and Leibniz on the basis, by the way, of some of the ideas of Pierre de Fermat. So when I delved into that, I had memories of a dwelling that I think was in Toulouse in France, where Fermat lived, and it had to do with a Roman ruin of some kind, and I have mental pictures of that and of walking around, and I've never been there in this life, but that's a kind of little vignettes or little glimpses of something in the past that come through and are magnified by the fact that I am practicing a spiritual technique for expanding consciousness. So I have those kinds of memories, but probably if I went there, I would feel, for instance, when I went to Europe, I found that certain places that I knew things that had happened there, and it had a strong effect on me, but they were more emotional things than things that could be easily verified with dates and numbers and exact locations.
Very good. And now let me turn to you, Vernon. In our previous interview, we titled it Archetypal Synchronistic Resonance, and we sort of danced around the topic of whether this is some sort of a synchronistic resonance or connection, or whether it actually represented reincarnation the way it is popularly thought of. And I wonder if you have an opinion about that now. Would you say you lean toward the idea that George Cantor was you in a previous lifetime, or would you prefer to think of it in terms of the historical person George Cantor was a spiritual influence upon you?
Very good question. I'm not sure if I have the answer. Certainly, the title, Archetypal Synchronistic Resonance, I think is a very good one, and it creates allowance for the Jungian archetypes and for synchronicities that occur, and Ed and I have had numerous synchronicities with us, with each other, and we think with some of these individuals maybe, and the synchronicities there really are not synchronicities pertaining to reincarnative elements more than extensions of knowledge, same directions, and people knowing what should be relevant in this, and it's almost as if we correspond with this. And I use the word correspond in a very special way, because initially when I looked at this, and in my previous interview, I spoke about the fact that the infinity of infinities was something that was described by Georges Cantor, and I was intrigued by it, and this was very obvious to me and very surprising that nobody else was talking about it. But there is another component as well, and that is, we spoke about set theory. And initially I was saying, well, you know, Georges Cantor developed set theory, and maybe that's a little different because I'm not involved with set theory very much. And then in my thinking over the last few years, I realized that I have a whole string of papers on one-on-one correspondences and correspondences that are like one-on-two and one-on-several. And I had written this and developed this as a concept and realized, hold on, this is an extension of set theory. So the important thing is our work seems to be extensions of the archetypal synchronistic resonance, but extensions that are very specific for myself and also for Ed. And it's interesting, if one looks at the reincarnation literature, sometimes one's talking about, do they look the same? And one of the individuals, when we were traveling in Romania, said, hold on, Ed looks more like Georges Cantor, and Vernon looks more like Pierre de Fermat. I cannot see those resemblances, except that Pierre de Fermat and I have those, that fuzzy kind, that kind of hair that Dagwood in the comics has, and also Albert Einstein has, and David Ben-Gurion, and Pierre de Fermat was a little different in that regard, but very similar. George Cantor is more specific and might have some resemblances to Ed. What I'm saying here is, in this resonance of links between myself and Ed, some of these elements fit each other and fit the other characters more than we expect. But the component pertaining to reincarnation out of interest is not something that just, well, Kevin Ryerson confirmed these identities, because I had somebody else saying to me, well, I'm Cleopatra. Well, there are many people who seem to think they were Cleopatra, this lady. And Kevin said, no, she was never Cleopatra. So that is interesting. And also with Ed, there were some links with his mathematics, with Pythagoras. And we asked, was Ed Pythagoras? And Kevin said, no, Ed was not Pythagoras, but was a student of Pythagoras. So it's interesting. There are variations here that are fascinating. And I am particularly intrigued in terms of these one-on-one correspondences, these one-on-two correspondences and beyond that, because that's very much where the set theory fits in, and also very much now where the idea of infinity fits in, because I somehow had almost perceived myself as pioneering the area of infinity, and I've published in that area as well. Every one of what we've quoted is not just sideline things, but areas that we've generally published on and spoken on. And I was intrigued that George Cantor, of course, could be regarded as the expert on infinity. So we both are complimented that there are these two very great mathematicians that we have links with. But historically, I suppose a lot of our work has been extensions of these and hundreds of publications in that regard. So that, to me, is quite exciting.
And let me ask you basically the same question, Ed. I know earlier you said that the popular image of reincarnation, meaning a linear succession that your soul goes from body to body to body, is not accurate, that you have a more sophisticated view of reincarnation. And I wonder if you could expand on that a little.
Spiritual evolution of consciousness is the basis of all forms of evolution and growth and expansion of understanding. So that's the part that survives and is magnified from one life to another. The what I would call superficial aspects of a personality that are picked up from the culture and the experience of that particular individual, those things are stored in the physical brain and are pretty much lost when a body passes away, either from natural causes or from catastrophic causes like an accident, a murder, or something like that. Those things are lost, but everything that adds to the knowledge of the one the unified consciousness, it carries through and is due to, we live in a cause and effect reality. My grandfather used to say, what is to be will be, even if it never comes to pass. And as a teenager, I asked my grandfather, what does that mean? And he explained to me that if you look at anything that is real, that actually occurs in your life or in this world, if you look at it after the fact, you'll find there were definitely causes and effects that brought that into play. So, from a broader perspective, and I gained this from Albert Einstein, who in his last footnote or appendix to his little book, Relativity, the Special and General Theories, a clear explanation that anyone can understand, which I read when I was 14, one summer, between high school years. He explained that time and space cannot claim an existence of their own. Time and space, or space-time, if you like, is a geometrical, we call it geometric, which relates to Earth, but it's basically a geometry of mass, energy, and consciousness. So, I think I don't want to get too far afield with this, but when you understand that time is a construct of mind, not a physical reality, then it clears a lot of this up. And I would like to quote my teacher, my guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, who said, and at the time he said this, I was blown away by it. He said, you don't necessarily reincarnate always in the future. You actually could reincarnate from this life to an existence in the past as well. So when you see time as a, like space, a three-dimensional reality, then it is possible to move in many directions. And as Einstein said, time is an invention to keep everything from happening at once. And I think that's a very astute statement. But from a 30,000 foot view, so to speak, of time and events, for instance, there's no time without an event. So time doesn't exist, like space doesn't exist as a thing of its own. From a 30,000 foot point of view, there is no era of time. That's created not by physics, but by consciousness. And we exist as triadic beings of physical, mental, and spiritual dimensions. We exist on the border between the infinitely continuous and the discrete quantized physical world and the infinitely continuous world of consciousness. When seen from this point of view, for me, it answers a lot of questions that are unanswerable otherwise, and why, and that's why I think reincarnation is a popular idea among people because it explains inequalities and seeming paradoxes and things that exist in linear time and linear space that aren't real. So I hope that made sense. I try to tie it together, but that's about the best I can do.
Thank you, Ed. I'm going to come to you again, Vernon, to see if we can't elaborate on that same question a little more, because I'm under the impression, let's say, with regard to Ed, that the possibility of a real reincarnation connection is much stronger, let us say, with Pierre Fermat than it would be with Albert Einstein, who was also obviously a big influence on Ed. And I wonder if you see that same difference.
I do. In fact, what's fascinating is I pointed out in that discussion that Ed and I are like one mind at times. I'll come along and I'll have a point, and Ed will have been thinking about the same point. It was a little bit different, but it was largely the same. In effect, it is so astonishing that we so correspond that, and I'm mentioning this because all of what Ed has said is what I would be saying, because it's the same kind of idea. But the correspondence is remarkable, to the extent that I was once at a conference and I was discussing with some of the people there. You know, Ed and I have very similar ideas. In fact, they seem to correspond, except we have one big difference, and that is that when one moves from the infinite to the finite, I felt that the components moved and it could be regarded in sort of the context of dark matter and dark energy as a completely different framework to Ed. And I pointed this out to these people because this was one of the few times that we totally disagreed. Just then Ed arrives and he says, you know what, Vernon, I've been thinking that if you look at it in the context of the photons that we were talking about, it's the same idea. It really is the infinite moving to a particular point of the same. So even there, they are the same correspondences. Very interesting there, and we've spoken about sparks. I don't like the idea of correspondences and saying, well, we are reincarnations, but certainly there are these elements that really are very, very close. I just am going to mention one other thing before I finish, and the one is the idea of we talk about souls being linear, you know, is he the soul of so-and-so? But my experience in sort of the area of survival, I can name at least one case at a personal level of somebody communicating and saying, after all, we were the same soul. And this intrigued me because, you know, you thought that souls were one on one. But this is not the example that I had. And it's the same thing here, a lot of what Ed talks about is what I talk about, and the correspondence with these major mathematicians is to me very exciting and very illuminating. But carry on our work.
And Ed, let me come back to you also. I'm under the impression that both in terms of Einstein's exposition that you've described regarding space and time, and in terms of yoga philosophy, the only real reality, the one real reality, is that all is one, that we are one with everything and everyone who ever lived on any planet anywhere in the universe. We're one with all of it, and everything else is sort of a relative truth, not a whole truth. So the idea that I am a separate person, that I am Jeffrey Mishlove and you are Ed Close, and we are completely different from each other, which is what we conventionally assume to be reality, is actually what the Hindus would call Maya, something of an illusion. Would you agree with that, or do you have a different way to couch it?
No, I do agree with that. And there are different levels of infinities, as we've spoken about, and that can be demonstrated very succinctly, mathematically. There are also different levels of truth, and I like to quote another mathematician, the Danish mathematician, Niels Bohr, who said that there are two kinds of truth: a trivial truth, which the opposite is plainly false, and a profound truth, the opposite of which is also true. And you can find examples of that. And the one that I like and that I put in my notes is: a trivial truth would be one that deals with details like you mentioned. We think of Jeffrey Mishlove and Edward Close as two totally separate and different manifestations of some level of consciousness. But in fact, those details are trivial truths, because we can demonstrate that the opposite of that trivial truth is false. If I say I am Jeffrey Mishlove, we can plainly demonstrate that that's not true. I have a birth certificate, and it does not say Jeffrey Mishlove on it. But a good example of a profound truth is the statement that something exists. And this goes to Leibniz again in his big question. Leibniz said that the thing that science should attack first is answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? It seems much more likely that nothing should exist rather than something should exist. But science clearly shows, as a trivial proof, that something does exist. So the opposite of something exists is nothing does not exist. And that's another profound truth. Nothing does not exist. So there's no such thing as nothing. And there is something, because if there hadn't not always been something, there wouldn't be anything now. So the profound truth, the opposite, the exact opposite of the statement that something exists, is that nothing does not exist, is also true.
Thank you, Ed. And let me come back to you again, Vernon, and talk about infinity for a minute. It strikes me that one way to think about this is that any individual consciousness is infinite. You are infinite. Ed is infinite. I'm infinite. Unfortunately, we're not capable of, our nervous system can't accommodate that kind of infinity. We simply can't hold it because of our physiological structure. But I also agree with William James and his idea of the pluralistic universe, that even each infinite consciousness is unique. It's not exactly identical to any other infinite consciousness. I wonder if you have reflections on that.
Wonderful question. And in a way, I agree with William James there, because, and questions of who William James is in terms of current consciousness is an interesting concept there. But the important point about it is, in my background, we can see different correspondences depending on how we look at it. And Ed and I have spoken about TDVP, is the triadic dimensional distinction vortical paradigm, and that is reflecting our nine-dimensional finite reality embedded within the infinite. And the infinite is a completely different component. All of this, you can look at it relative to what is going on. As us as individuals is quite different. However, when you look at it relative to a broader consciousness and broader awareness, we can be the same. We are not different. So it depends on where this fits in. And we have developed a model called unified monism. And I get a lot of my colleagues saying, well, you know, we like to be monists, or people like to be dualists, and they think it's the same. But unified monism, and I've published on this, fits in exactly with what we're talking about. It's the philosophical translation of our science. And all of this is, of course, linked up with the Cantor idea of infinity and extending infinity. And if this is onwards and onwards, it depends what the meaning is, where we go.
Well, I would like to thank both of you for being with me today and amplifying the very private video, which is now public, that Vernon and I made together 8 years ago, where I don't know that we've answered any final questions in today's discussion, but I think we've asked quite a few important questions, which should be of benefit to our viewers. I wonder if either of you have any final thoughts before we close our program.
No, thank you for doing this.
Yes, I quite agree. And just one quick comment about the infinities. I believe that James actually said that there are many, many realities. They're only separated by a very thin boundary, like the wing of a butterfly, perhaps. These infinities that we are, and as you pointed out, are limited by the synapses and neurons of our brains, are exceeded by the mind which exists and animates the brain and the body that we currently inhabit. So in my opinion, my humble opinion, the whole purpose of existence is for us to grow spiritually in our understanding of the infinity of what we are, and that potential is, again, referring to the mathematics, is underlined by Gödel's incompleteness theorem, that any infinity can be extended. And so time is an illusion, and we are all one with not only the universe, but the cosmos, which through the discovery of Gimel and the relationship of that computed in the hadronic matter of the universe, the stable atoms of the periodic table, coincides exactly with, well, so nearly exactly that statistically it's almost a certainty, with data from the Hubble probe determining that about 94.9% of the universe is dark matter and dark energy. It turns out that just about almost exactly the same amount of atomic matter is Gimel. This was actually Vernon did the statistical analysis of this, but I quite agree with that. And so for me, there is both direct experience, direct conscious experience, and experimental empirical evidence that supports this whole integration of consciousness monism that we're talking about.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you once again for being with me. I'd also like to encourage our viewers, our listeners, to check out the book the two of you have worked on together for years and co-authored, Reality Begins with Consciousness. If people are curious about Gimel, if they're curious about the triadic vortical dimensions of the universe, the answers can be found in that book. And I'd also suggest that our viewers might be interested in checking out some of the previous interviews on the New Thinking Aloud channel with both Ed Close and Vernon Nepi. I think between the two of you, there are about 20 interviews that can be found by checking out our listings. And finally, for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.